Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Former UCLA basketball star Ed O'Bannon was outraged when he found out that a video game company was using his image without paying him a dime. So he went to court.
And last week, a federal judge hearing his case issued a ruling that is poised to upset college athletics as we know it. The judge said that athletes like Ed O'Bannon are entitled to a share of the billions of dollars their sports generate.
The decision comes in the wake of a decision from the NCAA itself that schools can pay stipends to athletes and loosen recruitment rules. So are college athletics going pro? Is this the end of a highly commercialized system that some critics say was masquerading as an educational enterprise? And what does it mean to the handful of schools in the Northeast with big Division I sports programs like Boston College and the University of Connecticut? You can join the conversation as well. Should college athletes get paid? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And I'm going to start out with Doug Trabu. He's a producer for the NPR show Only a Game right here in Boston, and he's in our studio. Hey, Doug.
Hey, Anthony.
So let's talk about what happened last week, just to sort of bring us up to date. There was a big decision, of course, by federal judge Claudia Wilkin, but before we talk about that, the NCAA made some dramatic changes to the system on its own. So what did they do?
Right. This was a huge week for the NCAA. You have two big stories, and the first one involved the Big Five conferences for the NCAA, the most powerful, the richest conferences. That includes the ACC, which BC is a member of, also the Big Ten, the Big 12, the Pac-12, and the SEC in the Southeast. And so they basically have put out a set of rules that still need formal approval, but everybody thinks will happen, in which the Big Five conferences will have a lot more authority to make their own rules and sort of dictate how they govern themselves. And that could take the shape of full cost of tuition or full cost of attendance scholarships. So we've heard players complaining about they can't buy a pizza and they can't have a job. How do they make that work? Mm. Things to address that, they might add $4,000 or $5,000 a year to a scholarship. They could be talking about full four-year scholarships instead of year by year. They could be talking about long-term health insurance and maybe allowing players to have agents before they're out of school. All of those things will have to be presented and then approved, but we're on the road to some big changes for those big conferences.
All right, big change. Then on Friday comes this big decision from Judge Claudia Wilkins, federal judge, that athletes in big-time sports programs could reap some of the financial should reap some of the financial benefits of participating in those programs. So tell us a little more about that. First of all, how much money are we talking about?
Well, it's really kind of hard to tell at this point. This case revolves solely around the use of images, mm-hmm. the images of the players, their likenesses in video games and in television. And video games had kind of been resolved in a separate settlement. But moving forward, she placed a minimum that looks like $5,000 per athlete for the top tier football programs and the top tier basketball programs right. in Division I. So that's a figure that's just kind of there. Of course, you know, you could have 85 scholarship athletes on a football team. That's going to add up on a year-to-year basis for programs as they move forward.
Why $5,000, though? It seems like such an arbitrary figure.
Well, there's some speculation that it stems from comments about the idea that you'd be comfortable with athletes who are being paid $5,000 but not being paid $1 million. That seems to be an opening in just my reading of different analysis of this so far. That could be one area where we see a challenge. How did we come to that figure?
I see. So what's the scope of this ruling? In other words, we're talking about big-time college sports programs. Are we going to see collegiate badminton players get compensated for their sport?
Right now, it seems really focused on the two big money-making sports, men's basketball and football. Mm-hmm. The other issue, though, is that, you know, in the past, NCAA President Mark Emmert had suggested a $2,000 a year stipend for all college athletes. So the question is, where do you draw that line? And then again, you could see potential challenges down the road. Does a group of athletes say, hey, hockey is the big dog here at Boston College in some ways. We should be included in this. And how will that shake out? Different schools may have to do different things.
So, Doug, finally, let me just ask you about how this affects schools locally. The only school around here that would be affected by this directly is Boston College. By the way, they declined our offer to join this conversation today. And also close to home, University of Connecticut. Are there other smaller, downstream, smaller, less prestigious college sports programs around around Boston, around the Northeast that might be affected?
Well, definitely there will be some trickle-down effect. Those big five conferences that we were talking about, that's 65 schools. There's about 350 in Division I. So the rules are not exclusive to those big five conferences. The rules can be adopted by other schools if they choose to sort of opt in. But of course, it comes with the costs, and those schools don't necessarily have the finances. But if you're a fringe player, if you're UMass Amherst basketball and you want to compete and offer similar things that other bigger Division I programs are offering, you can come to that table, but you would need to fund all of those things.
Really interesting. Okay, big changes there. Doug Tribou, producer with Only a Game, stay with us. I want to introduce two more voices into this conversation. Dan Lebowitz has been on our show a few times. He's executive director at the Center for the Study of Sport and Society at Northeastern University, and he's back here in the studio. Dan, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us from the road, somewhere near Chicago, is John Bacon. He's a sports writer, a graduate of the University of Michigan. He's also author of Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football. John Bacon, good to hear you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Dan, let me start with you. I'd love to just ask you, do you agree with federal Judge Wilkin here that college players deserve to be compensated for their work? Is this good that she sort of opened the window to this possibility?
Well, I think that the conversation has been going on for a long time. Eddie O'Bannon actually filed this suit in 2009 and was a UCLA player a long time ago. A few years back, Taylor Branch wrote a very compelling argument in Atlantic Monthly about paying college athletes, where he started to talk about a free trade system and where college athletes fit within that free trade system. And so, you know, this isn't a conversation that's happened in a bubble, and it's not a compartmentalized conversation. I think what you're seeing now is a ramp up of that conversation, both in the courts and external to the courts.
Yeah. And what do you think of the decision? I mean, is it right? I mean, some people see college athletes as sort of indentured servants. Do you take that view? Should they be paid for what they bring to the universities?
I think that, you know, we live in a free trade system, and we live in a democracy defined many respects by capitalism. And I think that when you look at that system and you start thinking about coaches on the higher end of the scale at some of those 65 schools that might be making $4 million a year, and then you start thinking about athletes who, if they get a knee injury, lose their scholarship, there's a disparity. We just followed the mayor talking about economic disparity in the city, and I think that in many respects we live in a continuing conversation about what does economic disparity look like for people in college, in athletics, and in general life.
Yeah. John Bacon, love to come out to you there. Do you think the movement toward paying college athletes is unequivocally good? Or does this give you pause in some way as someone who has followed these big college sports programs over the years?
Well, here's the horrible part. It gives me pause not to, and it gives me more pause too. So where does that leave us? No doubt what Doug and Dave have said is dead right, of course, Dan, sorry, and that is that when your coach is making $4, $5, $6 million and a player can't transfer the same season, his coach leaves and breaks his contract, that you get paid nothing or you're not even a scholarship, you break your ankle and all this stuff, it is a system that is almost impossible to defend as it is. The flip side is, I think if you go to this pay the player system, and at $5,000, that's beyond mere expenses of flying home and going out for dinner. That's, you're getting paid at that point, at least something. You may be poorly paid, but you're paid. At that point, I think you start to change the whole dynamic of the equation. And you got to remember a couple of things. As crazy as the salaries are, and that's another issue, these are still nonprofit universities, usually state-funded to some degree. And you start getting in the business of paying your students while they're taking your classes. All kinds of conflicts of interest start kicking in. I teach at both Northwestern University in Chicago and Evanston, as well as U of M, University of Michigan back in Ann Arbor. And I write books for my living, not teaching, all peanuts, of course. But that's part of the point, too. When you teach in college, you are not getting paid market value. If capitalism has hit Michigan, it's not hit me yet. I can tell you that. So, I mean, I can make more than a one-hour speech than I can an entire semester of teaching at either school, and I sign up for this. So that's my deal. The difference between my situation and the student-athletes, if you will, is that they have no choice in football and basketball. So my theory is any solution you have along these lines is going to be inevitably and always a round peg in a square hole until you sign up for the Bacon plan, which is have the same thing in basketball and football you've had in baseball and hockey for over a century, and that is viable minor leagues. So if you want to get paid, you don't have to go to Boston College or Boston University. You can go down the street and play for the Paw Sox, and you'll be all set.
That sounds like a good idea. What do you think, Dan Lebowitz, of the John Bacon plan there?
I think you're pretty far down the stream already in terms of, the one thing that we've left out of this is the conversation around TV contracts and how big college sports is on a national landscape. And so really, we're talking about a push-pull between what pro athletics looks like and what college athletics look like. But if you turn on the TV on any Saturday, on any Sunday, at any night, you're going to see a college game, and that game's being funded in many respects by the ESPNs of the world. And so the question is, where do they fit in the economic equation, and how do they help these colleges in terms of future contracts? What do they look like with these organizations, with the broadcasting world, and how do some of these economic issues in terms of the complications of them get played out in that circumstance.
Here's the problem that I have, and I'd like to sort of ask all three of you to chime in. I mean, sort of in my gut, I understand intuitively where sort of the movement to pay athletes comes from. It seems to make sense. It seems to be about justice. But wasn't the original idea of college sports the idea to provide scholarships to young men and women, many of whom might not have had access to college education, so that they could get a college education? And seems like the whole idea of paying them sort of violates that principle. What do you think, John Bacon?
I agree with that basic notion. Again, the catch, and again, Dan and Doug have pointed this out, it works very well when Bo Schembechler arrives at the University of Michigan in 1969 for a grand total of $21,000.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a Michigan football player, well, guess what? Get your degree, you can probably do a whole lot better than your coach is doing at that point, at least financially, certainly. Those are no longer even digits in a contract, man. The comma has been replaced with a decimal point, and you're millions, obviously. So that's where it gets very difficult, as I said, to justify. But I think you're right. And the reason college football is so popular, and it's separate from the NFL, people don't get this, that when Bill Martin at Michigan did a survey of his season ticket holders 10 years ago, he's the athletic director at the time, he discovered that more than 60% of them had their tickets for 20 years or more. Very, very loyal. Only 9% also own tickets for any pro team anywhere, including Detroit, where most of them live. So the college football fan is not the NFL fan. They're different. In Boston, obviously, it's all Patriots and not much on BC, clearly. And if you understand that, when you start paying the players, what you have to be careful of is you're taking the fan for granted. And you're not selling prowess when you're selling college football. Even the Detroit Lions at their worst, and we've seen this many times, trust me, they can beat the Wolverines at their best no matter what. And yet the Wolverines draw twice as many fans as the Lions do. So does Penn State. They outdraw the Eagles and the Steelers, and Ohio State outdraws the Browns and the Bengals and Cleveland and Cincinnati, respectively. They're selling romance. If you start paying these guys and get into this, you might risk alienating the fan.
Interesting. Yeah, what do you think, Dan? Do you think we run the risk of alienating the college sports fan?
I think that the sports is on such a huge landscape and it's such a ubiquitous spotlight on it all day long, every day, that I actually don't think that's as big a risk as people think. I think that the appetite for sports, last week the NFL started to put sensors in the pads of players so that they could increase sort of fan engagement around how fast a player runs, how quickly a route is run, and other things. I think that the appetite for sports just keeps growing and growing, and I think it's fed in many respects by these TV contracts, the overexposure of it, and what I think as an academic as overexposure seems to be underexposure to most fans.
Yeah. Doug, I'd love to get you to chime in on this. I mean, this interesting idea that John Bacon put in play, just this idea of alienating fans, perhaps college sports fans, once we start paying these players.
I don't see that happening. I mean, I think to what Dan was saying, there's a thirst for college football, and the numbers just show that it's growing. The TV numbers keep going up. The TV networks keep paying more for it. And to your point about the education, I think that the NCAA has created some of these issues in part by ignoring some what a lot of people view as common sense proposals. Right now, you have, as we were saying earlier, 1 year at a time scholarship. So you blow out your knee, your chance to get that education is over. No chance. A lot of for the top players who have a shot at the NFL, that last semester's shot, if you want to go to the combine, if you want to go try to make the team, but they don't have a mechanism to get back to school. They'll give them two more years to attend college for free when they realize their NFL career isn't going to happen. Some of those things might help make that scholarship and that education seem more valuable as players get a little older and realize, hey, I'm not going to be the next Michael Jordan. I'm not going to be the next Tom Brady. Mm.
Doug, Dan, John, stand by. I want to get some listeners in on this conversation. We've already got some folks standing by. You can join the conversation. Should college athletes get paid? What do you think the consequences of this is? Where does it lead us? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. And let's go to Ben, who's calling from Cambridge. Go ahead, Ben. You're on the air.
Hi. So I was very much for a long time of the feeling that, you know, there's no way we can pay college athletes. It would get too complicated. And I have a friend who did college basketball. And just hearing his stories about how much time he spends in it. And this guy was talking on an average day, spending something of 6 to 8 hours preparing for practices in the morning and afternoon, which made me clearly see the investment in time of these kids, you know, money aside, is just ridiculous. And after that Shabazz Napier article, I believe, came out, we're talking about the food, right, that issue, I just felt that really, I think money gets too complicated, though I think we need to find some sort of compensation, whether that be support after or support during their academic experience, that would not make up, but support, just give them better time in college.
Ben, thanks so much for the call. John Bacon, I'd love your response to Ben, this idea, if not money, maybe some other way to compensate them.
I think Ben hits on a very good point, and I'm willing to bet that, again, Doug and Dan will probably agree with this one. The NCAA's accounting of its own hours, the allowable hours formula for a college athlete, it's so ridiculous. You cannot look at these things and not chuckle out loud. The Michigan hockey team, when they play a weekend series in Alaska, and Alaska's part of their league, believe it or not, for many years, the whole trip is about 114 hours all told. With the NCAA's accounting, which does not include travel, include taping, it includes all games at 3 hours, whether they're 3 hours or not, the whole thing comes to about 20 hours. They knock off around 90 hours of that trip that don't quote-unquote count. So tell that to a union worker, by the way, and see how far that one goes. You'll get paid for it. So he's dead right that the NCAA is living a lie as far as what it's really doing for these athletes. They're working on average about 40 to 45 hours a week on their sport. Time you could not spend studying, getting taped, stretching out, obviously working out, weight room, practice, and so on. So he's right about that. The question next, though, is what do we do about this? And that's very difficult. No doubt that players have got a good case. But my advice here is still be careful what you wish for. There's Title IX that kicks in very quickly.
This gets to a really interesting question, John, that I wanted to ask you all about. What are the implications to all this with regard to Title IX? Does this mean that female college athletes are next in line for a payday? Dan, I'd love to come to you on that.
I think you can't, we talked about compartmentalization earlier. I don't think you can compartmentalize this and not start thinking about Title IX. I think that there's going to be issues around Title IX. I think what this is a conversation that's really galvanized in a quick period of time, and a lot of things still need to be sorted out, not the least of which is the court decision and whether or not it will stand. But the issue is that really, when Northwestern came out and wanted to be unionized, people used the word unionized. But really, that was an athlete's bill of rights. So again, we're caught up in this whole free trade system versus a union system concept where the words being union were supposed to be scare everybody. When you say the word union, in some respects, that's a scary word to a lot of people in a moneyed structure. And yet, on the other side of the coin, we're in a free trade system. So free trade seems to be sort of scary in this respect to those same people. So this is an ironic argument, an evolving argument, an argument that's going to take a long time to shake out. But it's a conversation that needed to happen and has been in the making for a very long time.
Well, it's happening in a big way. Let's go to Judy, who's calling from Lincoln. Judy, you're on the air.
Yes. My daughter was a full scholarship athlete at UCLA. Not in a money sport. She was swimming. I wanted to correct one of your callers. If you are injured while you are on a scholarship, an athletic scholarship, your scholarship continues if you are unable to participate in that sport. So you're not robbed of a college education. The second thing was I wanted to correct you say, gee, Bo Schembechler or whatever, Michigan coach is making $2 million a year. There's a lot more money coming in than just his salary. And that pays for swimmers like my daughter's education. It pays for other scholarships. I don't think college athletes should be paid. I think you're putting them into a whole other ballpark and a framework, and you just sort of ruin the whole non-professional beauty of the sport.
Judy, it's a great point. I appreciate you putting it on the table. Thanks so much. John Bacon, I want to come to you and sort of bounce off one of sort of related to what Judy was talking about, because the Big Ten commissioner, Jim Delaney, as well as other NCAA officials have argued that paying student athletes will hurt college sports. And I'm wondering, can you explain their thinking on this? How would this hurt college sports? Is this just a bottom line issue that it would just take too much money away from the universities in general? And there's Judy talking about, you know, her daughter benefiting from a college sports program.
It's funny to make that argument, and the commissioners are predisposed to do so, clearly, so is ESPN and others who are getting a great deal. So I'm reluctant to agree with them on that basis. However, they're listening to it. And certainly at Michigan, for example, I did a calculation on this. A fifth-year senior has taken in around $586,000. He's out of state for paying tuition, and they do pay full price, the department does. That does not count strength and conditioning, tutorial help, and so on, which we would all have to pay for, obviously, if you're going to train for the NFL or whatever. So there is some money that gets to most athletes. And at Northwestern, by the way, the average scholarship is around $65,000 all told, so per year. So that's not chump change, and ask a parent who's paying that, of course, and they'll tell you that. So there is that aspect there, too. Hmm. I pointed out earlier the romance versus prowess argument, which might have an effect as well. We watch the Little League World Series on ESPN every August from Pennsylvania, not because the 12-year-olds are so phenomenally good, but because the romance of it draws us in. So we don't know what the effect is going to be on the fans. My colleagues disagree on that one, perhaps, but that's an aspect as well. I think one other factor on the practical side is Title IX is virtually undefeated in these matters. If the quarterback gets $5,000, so does the female rower, the female softball pitcher, and so on. And most schools would have a hard time paying for that. P65 might be able to do it with the TV contracts, but everyone else falls off pretty quickly. So there is that aspect as well. I think a far more troubling aspect to me is, I come back to this, these are actually universities. And at schools like Oregon and LSU, they're having big problems with their budgets. The schools are in trouble, while the athletic departments are making piles and piles of money. Something about that strikes me as odd at best.
Dan,
that could be a problem down the road.
Sure, that's a problem down the road indeed. Dan, a lot of universities outside the big conferences actually lose money on intercollegiate athletics. And just this week, the New York Times raised the provocative question, and if that's the case, why have intercollegiate programs if they lose money?
I think that you see an awful lot of universities lose money. You see certain universities evaluate programs. BU and Northeastern both actually got rid of football because of this, and they've tried to build up their programs related to, you know, more expansion of Title IX programs and the like. And so I think that's a very good model too. I mean, this is a discussion. It's not something where we say this is all right and this is all wrong. If I look at the Northeastern model or the BU model, I think it's a great model. You know, and so, you know, I can agree with many points that John's making about the romance issue, about college athletics, about how you have all this access to great food and great facilities and the like. But it is an ongoing conversation on both sides.
Well, it's an ongoing conversation. I want to thank all three of you for making it go so well and interestingly. That's Dan Lebowitz. He's executive director at the Center for the Study of Sport and Society at Northeastern University. Dan, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And John Bacon, sports writer, author of Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football, speaking to us from the road somewhere near Chicago. John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'll see you in Ann Arbor probably in a couple of weeks.
Love it.
And Doug Tribou, producer of NPR's Only a Game, thank you for coming out.
Thanks, Anthony.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, the latest in the Market Basket labor feud. I'm Anthony Brooks with Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.